Chapter 15. Into Fire. Zukova gestured, and Creed moved the fire teams forwards. The air in the vent stank of sulphur, and it was so warm and close it made their lungs tight. All of them were streaming with sweat. The entire environment felt toxic in the worst way. Every now and then a rank breath of air would rumble along the duct from far below. Creed kept expecting a super-hot vent of gas to come boiling up and roast them where they stood.
"Down from here," Zukova said, a wide vertical duct connected to the horizontal one they had been following.
Rusted grip rails ran down one side for use by servitor work crews. The drop glowed with bioluminescent algae.
"You sure?" asked Obel.
Zukova had been tracing the pattern on her palm with her index finger. She coughed and nodded. Mags peered down the drop.
"Straight down?" he asked.
"Yes," said Zukova. 50 meters or so. It meets the main thermal outflow. We can intercept the hostiles."
"How are we going to get the support weapons and flamers down that?" asked Ifan.
"Carefully," said Creed.
She swung over the lip, got her feet on the first grip rail, and looked at them.
"Come on," she said.
Pasha stopped pacing. She looked over at Spetnin at the arcade hatch.
"It's getting quieter out there," he said. "No more assaults in the last few minutes."
Pasha nodded.
"We've given them long enough. Ready up. We're taking that Gnosis repository."
Her squads prepped weapons. Pasha rechecked the antique sleet gun she had spent the last few minutes examining. She was confident that she understood its function. She'd taken a satchel of shells from one of the Skitari corpses. She was going to need decent stopping power. At the compression hatch, Mora's squad was ready, lined up for fast assault. At her nod, Lud punched the hatch key. The compression hatch sighed on its hydraulics and opened. The Gnosis repository was quiet. The bodies of their dead lay where they had fallen. Mora's team led the way, moving quickly, weapons hunting for movement. Elam's first squad followed, with Lud. Pasha led the third assault element inside. Nothing moved. No fire came their way from the ducting network at the far end. Lud glanced into the open crypt safe.
"Etruin," he said.
Pasha glanced in at the Verse Engine Seer's corpse, face up on the crypt floor. Her brow crinkled with distaste.
"Keep moving," she instructed.
Mora's squad approached the repository's far end. Steam gutted from several subducts that had been forced to release pressure. The heavy lid of the main down duct had been forced and lay on the deck. Broken locking bolts were scattered on the ground around it. Pasha pushed forwards and leant over to peer down the duct.
"Faith's sake," said Elam. "Don't just go sticking your head in there."
She regarded him sarcastically.
"Head still attached," she told him,
gesturing to her neck.
"The enemy is in there and running. I pray to Throne that Tona and Lunny have got their strength down in front of them. We box them in like rats in a pipe. So, Asa, I am going to stick more than just my head in there."
She heaved herself out onto the duct's access ladder, a metal frame that ran down into the darkness below.
"You coming?" she asked. "Or have I got to do this alone?"
A light rain had started to fall out of the low, ink-black sky. Behind them, the last crackle of exchanged fire with the insurgents echoed from the end of the approach road. Bray signaled, and the first of the squads moved out, running low and quiet across the rock-crete apron towards the gatehouse. Chiria and Haller brought up the rear, lugging a .20 and ammo box between them, moving at a shuffling trot. Bray threw a stop signal and tossed a rock towards the gatehouse. It clattered across the open yard, in range of the gatehouse sensor net. Nothing stirred. No lights kicked in. No hum of auto-aiming weapons. The place was dead. Bray let his breath out. If the gatehouse had been live, it would have probably stopped them cold. Cracking that kind of bunker was treadwork. Besides, if the gatehouse had opened up, the slaved weapons in its embrasures would easily have had enough reach to hit the bomb truck they pushed up out of range of the insurgents behind the highway rise. They moved in. Bray waited, edgy, as McCoyne burned through the outer door's lock with a cutting torch. He towed open the heavy door, the lock mechanism still glowing and dripping gobs of molten steel. The ghosts made entry, clearance style. Gatehouse Command was dead, and so were the two Urdeshi steelsiders in it. The whole place was torn apart by intense gunfire. The walls were peppered with blast holes, and the floor was covered in drifts of spent brass. Smoke fumed the air. Monitor screens hung, shattered and crazed. Those still linked and functional displayed dead air feeds. A noxious smell wafted from dead things caged in each of the bunker's gun embrasures. They checked the bodies. Both steel-siders had been riddled with bullets at close range. The smashed ruin of a gun servitor lay near the door. One of the dead automata's cyclic cannons was still rotating, a dry, grinding whir. It had emptied its entire munition canisters. Chiria set down the heavy .20 and relieved one of the dead Urdeshi of his .30 short snout, strapping the hip-mounted onto a gyro-stable body frame.
"Easier to carry," she said.
Halla nodded and secured the other short snout. They straightened out the fat, armored feed belts. The slaved auto-hoppers were dead, too, but Chiria found the release catches and lifted the hoppers from their mountings. They were heavy, but she and Halla hefted them up like buckets. Bray moved through the inner door and entered the walkway across the ditches. Rain pattered down, jingling the chain mesh. He led the fire team advance. There was a caged inner run beyond the ditches. The meshing here had been torn down.
"Something was penned here," said McKellar.
Bray nodded. Whatever it was loose. Trooper Armin called to Bray there was something on the ground near the door to the main wall. It looked like a large dog. They approached carefully. It was a biomech thing, a quadruped defense servitor of canine build. What organics it possessed had originally been human. The sight of it disgusted them both. It was sprawled on its side. They could tell it was still alive, though its vitals were collapsing. "Shot?" Bray shook his head. Thick black mucus was welling from the creature's steel jaws, and films of it crusted the thing's eyes. Its systems had crashed. It had been compromised and corrupted, and that corruption was now killing it. Bray keyed his bead.
"Pray to Colossim. Go. We've reached the inner gate. The place is dead. No contacts. Can confirm signs that the Mechanicus elements turned. Probably some kind of mechanical infection. I don't know the right word, but it got in their system, drove them mad, and then shut them down."
"Dead?"
"Looks like it, sir. Burned them out really fast. But they went down feral. No signs of gunfire from inside."
"How long to main entry?"
Bray and Armin tried the massive blast door. It was sealed tight.
3, maybe 4 minutes to cut an entry."
"Copy that. Get it done."
Behind the transports on the approach road, Colossim looked at the men behind him, ready to deploy.
"Move up," he said. "Bray's about to let us into the place. It's gone quiet, but stay sharp."
He turned to look at EM-14.
"Let's go,"
he ordered. Behind him, 2 full companies of ghosts began to advance on the gatehouse. Eli Rawn's plans always erred towards the simple. Life had taught him that much. The more moving parts, the more chance there was for something to go very wrong. He liked lean plans that were supple enough to absorb nasty surprises. His plan for Camp Xenos had been so lean there wasn't a scrap of body fat on it. Get in, grab Mabon, get out. But life, or some great external power that Rawn didn't choose to believe in, was laughing at him from the void. It had other ideas. He'd been anticipating Sekhite insurgents, or, at the very worst, Paxun units. He'd chosen to move light, with just one section, to make the most of speed. The things he was facing instead, Kimura, the Fagoth had called them, were the sort of freaks that made that great external power in the void positively hoot with glee. The great external power in the void wasn't something Rawn had any plans to get to know on a personal level. For a start, the great external power probably had a face like a Grox's puckered arse. But sometimes, times like this, Rawn felt a burning desire, like an ingot of foundry-fresh steel sinking deep down in his gut, to meet that laughing feather face to face and have words. Strong words. Strong words punctuated by straight silver every time Rawn made a salient point. With Varl and Brosten in tow, he'd barely got Mabon into the main guardhouse when the yard front area lit up. Cardass called out 4 shooters, minimum. They were pinned down. Their transport was sitting in the yard near the gate block, just 30 meters, but the Rockcrete yard was wide open all the way. It might as well have been parked on Balhout. Rawn reviewed his situation fast. Most of the Camp Xenos garrison had been dead by the time he'd arrived. He'd lost several good men of his own just getting inside. In the time it had taken him to secure Mabon, troopers Ockle and McFarrig had been butchered too. Oyston, his adjutant, had also taken a hit. She'd survived, but the Lasbold had destroyed her Voxcaster set. That meant no warning was getting out. No message to Pasha that the frighteningly resilient things currently killing his men were also probably coming for her, in larger numbers. It also meant there would be no calling for help. Oyston was pissed off about it. If there had been time, Rawn would have enjoyed seeing his normally meek and precise adjutant getting riled.
"I just got that feather tuned up," she snarled.
He helped her pull the smashed Voxcaster unit off her back. More shots ripped in through the windows and outer door.
"It seems your exit route is blocked,"
Mabon asked. Rawn glared at him.
"Strangely enough, prisons aren't built with multiple exits," he replied.
He signalled Brosten forward to join the ghosts defending the front of the guardhouse. Val was sticking tight beside the Fegoth.
"We could do with another shooter, you know," Val said to Mabon.
"I don't want a gun,"
Mabon replied.
"Not really your choice," said Rawn, snatching fire through a window slit.
"Oddly, it is,"
said Mabon.
"I've been a prisoner for too long. Colonel, how many years has it been now? And every day, you and your ghosts actively preventing me from having anything at all, that could remotely be used as a weapon."
"I let you keep your mouth, didn't I?"
Rawn spat. Trooper Kalin uttered a grunt as a well-placed lasround found his forehead and threw him back from the window slot. He was dead before he hit the floor. Rawn cursed. The archenemy were incredibly effective, and his team were penned in a target building that was being demolished around them one lasbolt at a time. The Suicide Kings, his fine first section, had been reduced to 8. Him, Oyston, Val, Belvile, Brosten, Cardass, Laidley, and La Herf. End of an era. End of the infamous kings. He was damned if this was how he was going to go out. Then again, he reflected, I'm probably long since damned anyway.
I told Sergeant Val this, and I'll tell you too, Colonel,
said Mabon.
It's me they want. They don't care about you, except to kill you on their way to me. Let them have me. And spare?
No.
Rawn?
No, Mabon, said Rawn. I've got orders, a duty, and duty only has 2 endings, accomplishing it or...
I know the other one,
said Mabon. Rawn got in beside Laidley, who was burning through his ammo at another of the window slots.
Cardass says 4, said Rawn.
That's what I count, sir,
said Laidley.
1 on the roof of that bunker there, 2 in the blockhouse beside it, the other one up by the gate.
A burst of Laz bracketed the slot. Laidley stopped pointing, and he and Rawn ducked. Rock creaked chippings and metal fragments rained down on them.
You'll have to take my word on the last one, Laidley said.
What did that bunker look like to you?
Rawn asked. Laidley shrugged.
A silo, maybe?
That's what I thought, he replied.
Xenos was a prison, not a fortress. It wasn't designed to keep attackers out. It was designed to keep people in. Vital elements like the guardhouse or any garrison areas or arsenals would be securely distanced from the cell block compound.
Belvile!
Rawn called out. Trooper Belvile was holding another window slot, several meters left of Rawn.
Sir,
the Belladon called back.
Think you can lob one onto that bunker?
Belvile pulled a face, assessing his very limited angle of fire.
Dunno, sir, he said.
Let me rephrase, said Rawn. Lob one onto the bunker, Belvile.
Belvile nodded. First Section, B Company, the Suicide Kings, were Rawn's personal squad. Every ghost in it had been hand-picked by him. In the early days, they'd all been Tanith, because Rawn had nursed an antipathy to any new influx from Vergust or Belladon. But he had mellowed. Skill sets and raw talent mattered more to him than some notion of loyalty to a world that no longer existed. That, and the fact that so many of the original Tanith in First Section had been smoked over the years, he'd needed replacements. Like the first Scout Carder, B Company First Section followed its own rules. It was part of the privilege of membership. Rawn allowed greater discretion in weapon choice. He liked the idiosyncratic adaptability of variety. The Suicide Kings went to work packing a range of firepower, normally found in elite stormtroop platoons. Ockle, throne rest him, had carried a large-caliber autogun that chambered armor-piercing rounds. Conglan, now dead out in the yard somewhere, had favored a hellgun. Oyston, along with her voxcaster, lugged a stockless riot gun and a bag of breaching shells. Cardass carried a box-fed .20 stubber with a pump shotgun cut-down, bolted under the primary barrel. Laherf and Belval had standard pattern las rifles like Vals, but both had increased the carry weight by a third through the addition of underbarrel grenade launchers. Belval slotted in a chunky crack grenade and lined up at the slot, scooting across for the best angle. Heavy enemy fire kept licking at his position, making him duck.
"Take your time," Val said. "No fethin' rush."
The ceiling collapsed. A Kimura dropped down onto them in a shower of flakboard and masonry debris. He landed on Laherf, breaking both of the man's legs. Laherf was still screaming when the Kimura struck him with a fistful of talons. The blow lifted Laherf off the ground, spinning him in midair, blood jetting in all directions from his torn throat. He landed hard. The Kimura reached for Laherf's weapon. Ignoring the tight confines, Cardass opened up across the room with his .20. The deafening hard round burst tore chunks out of the Kimura's chest and shoulder and threw him against the guardhouse wall. Despite severe wounds that would have killed a standard human instantly, the Kimura lurched forward again with a roar, neon blood pouring from his injuries, and opened fire with Laherf's weapon. Belval was killed at his window slot. Oyston was winged. Cardass was hit in the left hip and overbalanced. Brosten hit the Kimura in the side of the head. He was using one of his flamer tanks as a club. Two blows knocked the creature down, and Brosten kept beating, slamming the heavy metal cylinder into its skull over and over again.
"There,"
he said, finally tossing the tank aside. It was slick with neon blood. The Kimura had nothing left above the neck except a spatter of yellow paste and bone shards.
"Knew there'd be more than one way to kill these bastards with a flamer."
Oyston was already up, blood oozing from her shoulder. She and Rawn ran to Cardass.
"I'm all right,"
Cardass said. He wasn't. His hip was a ragged mess. Oyston reached for field dressings, but Cardass told her where she could stick them. He heaved himself back to his window slot and started to fire his stubber again. Val had dashed across to Belval's position.
"Sorry,"
he said to Belval's corpse. Val felt bad about it. No man deserved to be mocked the instant before his death. Val set down his own rifle and hoisted Belval's. He checked the grenade was still set in the tube launcher.
"Call it, bunker,"
he asked, peering out of the slot.
"Would you?"
Rawn shouted back. Prolonged bursts of fire were striking the guardhouse facade. Val angled the gun and fired the underbarrel. It launched the grenade with a sound like an ogryn hawking into a tin spittoon. The grenade sailed up and out, described an arc across the contested yard, and landed on the bunker roof. It exploded with a fierce sheet of flame that was entirely consumed a second later by the detonation of the bunker itself. Rawn had been right. Camp Xenos kept its munitions store away from the main buildings. The blast was considerable. It battered the gate area, swallowed their transport in a shock of expanding flame, and blew out the blockhouse beside the bunker. A cone of fire lifted off the bunker site, blooming out into the night sky like a mushroom cap. Debris rained down. They could hear secondary pops and bangs as stored munitions and power cells caught and cooked. Something landed in the yard along with the debris from the blockhouse. The Kimura, one of the shooters using the blockhouse as cover, had been cut in two. He was scorched and dripping yellow fluid. His head lolled, and he began to drag his upper half across the yard towards the guardhouse with his spasming hands.
"Kill it,"
Rawn told Cardass.
"He's been cut in half." "Does he look dead?"
Rawn asked.
"He doesn't look dead to me."
Cardass angled his .20 down and raked the clawing mass with stubber fire until it stopped moving.
"Move," Rawn yelled. "We're out now."
The blast had killed one for certain, maybe more. Whatever their losses, the Kimura squad had been blinded and rocked. They had a moment of opportunity. Val grabbed Mabon.
"Truck," he said.
"That's gone," Rawn replied. "Head for the wire and out."
Val bundled Mabon through the door. Laidley followed, then Oyston. Brosten grabbed Ockle's big autogun and ran out after them. Rawn looked at Cardass.
"Judd, now," he barked.
Cardass smiled.
"You need covering fire, sir," he said.
He locked eyes with the colonel. Rawn knew what he actually meant was, I can't walk. Hip's gone. I'm bleeding out, and there aren't enough of you to carry me and stay functional. This is where you ditch me.
Cardass?
Cardass ignored him, lining up his .20.
Covering fire in three, he said.
Two.
Suicide Kings, Rawn thought. Like the old card game. It had seemed like a clever name once. He ran out across the yard after the others, his head low. There was burning debris everywhere. Cardass's heavy fire ripped from the guardhouse window slot and punished the gate and the front of the blazing blockhouse. Val had reached the fence. High chain wire and a ditch separated the prison's front yard from the perimeter of the neighboring vapor mill. The mill loomed, pale in the night, exhaling huge, crawling plumes of white steam from its stacks. The night was cold. They had the heat of the flames behind them, and the night breeze in their faces. The bunker blast had taken down several sections of the security fence. Val led the way, scrambling over the flattened fencing. Rawn was the last to arrive. Lasbolts whipped around him as he ran. He fell. He tried to get up. Behind him, a Kimura was walking slowly out of the inferno of the blockhouse. His blistered form was still on fire, and a splinter of roof spar had impaled his chest. He was firing his las rifle from the hip, as if that was the highest he could raise it. Rawn heard the rattle of Cardass's stubber. A sustained burst of fire knocked the Kimura back into the flames. Rostin grabbed Rawn's arm and dragged him to his feet.
"Come on, Chief!" he yelled.
"All right," said Rawn.
"You sure?"
Rostin asked.
"Yes,"
said Rawn. He decided not to mention the las round that had gone through his abdomen. He could feel the blood running down his thigh and into his groin. They headed for the fence. Behind them, Cardass's weapon fell silent. Gunfire from the remaining Kimura warriors chased them into the night.
"This isn't a rescue," said McColl, as the third stasis tank finished draining.
Milo nodded.
"I understand," he said.
"What is it, then?"
asked Marzo.
"An opportunity," said McColl.
Colonel Marzo was the first prisoner Milo had insisted on releasing. He was a stocky, middle-aged officer from the Urdeshi 4th Light Cinderstorm, who had been assigned to the Saint as military liaison by High Command after her arrival on the Forge World. He'd served with her ever since, which made him Enkil Vahakan. He and Milo had been captured together.
"How did that happen?" McColl had asked.
"Urupan," Milo had told him.
"The Saint had achieved a miracle at Grepin. The archenemy was reeling. She became convinced that Sek was located nearby. Urupan. A place called Pinnacle Spire. So we went in fast, so as to not lose momentum. There was a trap."
"A trap?"
McColl had asked. "For her. A warp vortex. He wasn't really there, you see. He was projecting himself using psychers. Well, the trap failed. She survived. The vortex destabilized. The blowback hurt Sek, I think. Hurt him badly. And we were too close. We were pulled through to his side. Blink of an eye, and we were aboard his ship." The last of the nutrient suspension flashed from the third tank. Marzo was sitting on the rusted deck, trying to shake off the raw ache of stasis shock. He was peering around, half-blind and dazed. He finally reached into his tunic pocket and pulled out a pair of rimless spectacles. One lens was cracked. He'd lost just about everything except his ragged Urdeshi fatigues, but somehow his spectacles had survived. He got up to help them as McColl opened the third tank's hatch. It took all three of them to drag out the body inside. It was a massively heavy dead weight. They laid the body on the deck, and Milo pulled the vox plugs out of its temples.
"Pain goods," said McColl. "They weren't going to take any chances."
They looked down at the body. Cater Holofernes, of the Adeptus Astartes Iron Snakes, had been stripped of his plate armor and left in its ragged underskin a tight mesh body glove. The armor had not been removed efficiently, and many of the intercutaneous plugs and anchor points had been damaged. The snake's body had been studded with steel spikes, each one staked into a major muscle group or joint. The spikes were pain goads designed to paralyze and incapacitate. Each one had a small rune glowing on its head. Holofernes moved his head and uttered a low groan. Fluid ran from his mouth, and his eyes blinked open, glassy.
"He's immobilized," said McColl. He drew his skerret.
"You're going to end his pain?" Marzo asked.
"Of course he isn't," said Milo.
Holding the serrated edge of the blade flat, McColl began to lever the goads out of Holofernes's flesh. As each one came free, a shudder of pain ran through the Space Marine. Blood and other bio-liquids dribbled from each wound. They reminded McCall of the stigmata he'd heard some sacred beings displayed. It was going to take a while. It took effort to dig each goad free and pull it out. McCall took the last pistol from his waistband and handed it to Milo.
"Watch the hatch," he said.
"How long do we have?"
asked Mazo. McCall didn't reply. Mazo limped around the chamber and peered into the other tanks. Two of the other prisoners were comrades from Urapan, both men from Mazo's command. They hadn't survived the vortex intact. It was not possible to free them from suspension. Mazo turned away and closed his eyes.
"Who are you?"
Mazo asked.
"That's McCall," whispered Milo from the doorway.
"The ghost?" Mazo looked intrigued. "Brin's told stories about you."
"They were all true," whispered Milo.
"So how many of you are there aboard?" Mazo asked. "I told you this wasn't a rescue," said McCall, plucking out another goad.
"How many?" McCall looked at him. Something in his eyes made Colonel Mazo recoil slightly.
"Just me."
"How did you get here?" Mazo asked.
"Pure blind chance and an obstinate nature," said McCall.
"I'll bet,"
whispered Milo.
"Do they know you're here?" Mazo asked. "Are they looking for you?"
"Stop with the questions,"
Holofernes growled. He opened his eyes and looked up.
"McCall,"
he said in a low voice.
"War brother," replied McCall, nodding.
"Come to kill me?"
asked Holofernes. "You'd be dead," said McCall, yanking the last goad out of the Space Marine's torso. Holofernes laughed, but the laugh turned into a wince.
"Pain goods," said McCall, moving down to the legs. "I'll have the last of them out in a few minutes. Then some feeling might return."
"I'm not sure I wanted to,"
said the Iron Snake. He sat up.
"Already?"
said Mazo, amazed.
"Pain focuses the mind,"
said Holofernes, flexing his hands.
"Doesn't it just?" replied McCall.
Holofernes held out a huge hand to McCall.
"Give me that," he said. "I'll finish it."
McCall handed him the dagger. Holofernes leaned forwards with a grunt and started to hook the goads out of his paralyzed legs. McCall rose.
"What did you mean when you said opportunity?" Mazo asked, rising too. "I'm here by blind luck. You're here by bad luck. Luck alone led me to you," replied McCall.
"Not sure it was luck," whispered Milo. "The influence of the Beatty flows."
"Not here it doesn't," said McCall.
Milo looked at him.
"This ship is sitting at the heart of the archenemy's primary stronghold on Odesh," said McCall. "The enemy is here in brigade strength, all around us. The nearest Imperial force is 90+ kilometers from here, and no one on our side knows of this location."
"So, we're behind enemy lines, cut off, without support?"
asked Holofernes, yanking a goad out of his knee.
"In the heart of a nest of devils."
"The odds are not in our favor," said McCall.
"Is there a way out?"
asked Mazo.
"No,"
said McCall simply.
"So all that matters is what we do while we're here?"
asked Milo.
"What we accomplish before they find us and take us out?"
"Yes,"
said McCall.
"And you've already decided what that could be, I'm guessing,"
said Holofernes.
"Yes,"
said McCall. The Iron Snake pulled out the last of the goads and hauled himself to his feet. He grimaced as locked muscles eased and flexed. He got upright, then immediately slumped, leaning hard on the hatch door of his tank. McCall darted to support him and stop him toppling.
"Thank you, brother,"
said Holofernes, his voice laced with pain.
"I'll be myself again in a moment, I promise." "Lean on something,"
growled McCall through gritted teeth.
"You're too fething heavy to hold upright."
Holofernes chuckled and shifted his weight, getting a better grip on the rim of the heavy hatch. McCall straightened up.
"So tell me,"
Holofernes said. McCall frowned thoughtfully.
"We'll have 3 choices, he said. "One is to try and annihilate this stronghold from inside. I think finding the means to do that will be near impossible. The second is more viable. We try to commandeer a communications station or similar, get a message out, alert Crusade Command to this location in the hope that airstrikes or orbital bombardment can level it."
"That works,"
said Holofernes.
"Astartes code can verify us and emphasize the significance of our signal. If High Command isn't asleep at the helm, fleet elements could have this site triangulated and locked in 7 or 8 minutes.
Loss of this stronghold would cripple Sec's efforts on Ordesh, McCall agreed. So that strategy has a lot going for it. What's the third idea? Asked Mazza.
Sec, said McCall.
He's the key. Whatever damage the Crusade does to his armies, they will continue to be a threat all the while he's alive. And he's here. On this vessel.
But a fleet strike, Mazza began.
There's always a chance he could escape, said Holofernes.
He can't escape if he's dead, said Milo.
So, if we can only attempt one thing, and we want it to have the maximum effect, said McCall.
He let the rest hang, unsaid. No one spoke for a moment.
Whichever we choose, said Mazza, we're dead.
McCall looked at him.
You need to grasp, sir, he said, that we're dead already.